I hear the talking of the DJ. Can't understand just what does he say. Well, I'll tell you what. This DJ, he's actually not DJing. That's Dave in command doing the DJing tonight. I did pick the tunes, though. A lot of information from Peter Lance tonight. And his website has a whole lots of there. You can spend a few minutes on each one of the elements on this site, peterlance.com. Check it out. His new book is Deal with the Devil. And right now we're covering the part about how between the FBI and the newspapers, guys wind up on the Monday morning hit list. Very interesting. And how this all ties in with TWA 800 and the World Trade Center attacks as well. This is Coast to Coast AM. We shall return. Dun dun. Okay, Peter Lance, let's pick it up where we left off.
It's important to understand if my theory is to be considered with any kind of even-handedness, what the motive would have been for a cover-up of such an extraordinary event as the crash of TWA-800. I want to preface by saying that a very extraordinary thing happened the night of that crash. There was a White House Situation Room meeting convened, unheard of for a plane crash in the U.S. I don't want to say guarantee in this day, post 9/11, that there wasn't a sit room meeting today as a result of the crash in San Francisco, but I would highly doubt it. But that night there was, because they knew about Youssef's prediction, right? They knew that Youssef had already predicted he was going to put a bomb in a plane to get a mistrial. He'd already told it to Scarpa. Their FBI is seeing this data, and they're recording it in their own 302 memos. And then the next day, Youssef asked for a mistrial, and Judge Duffy, Kevin Duffy, the judge, who's this extraordinarily great judge from the Bronx, tough Irishman, basically says something he could not have known. And he says to the jury, whatever happened last, the crash off of Long Island has nothing to do with this case. Well, he couldn't have known that. And yet he was telling the jury just to disregard it, but he was also kind of making a ruling in denying Youssef's motion for mistrial. So now let's go back and consider the context of the Third Colombo War and what was going on in the Eastern District while the Bojinka trial is proceeding in the Southern District, okay, across the East River. There were 75 cases, I told you, and over the years in these prosecutions, 14 of the defendants basically were either got new trials or were allowed to, walk initially because the two judges believed that the feds had a duty to give the information about the relationship between Scarpa and Linda Vecchio to defense attorneys. So the cases were threatening with unravel, the whole 75 cases. So the feds were terrified of losing all these mob cases, as you can imagine. So now Scarpa Jr. is, by 1996, when he's doing this in terrorism sting, these cases have been winding through the courts for 4 years. And as I started to say, there was a OPR, Internal Affairs Investigation, opened on Linda Vecchio that commenced in January of 1994 and didn't end until August of 96, a few months later. And that investigation generated 900 pages of transcripts and investigative material. And if Linda Vecchio had been basically found to have leaked this information to Scarpa, then he would have not only lost his job and his pension, he would have been criminally prosecuted. But remember what I said earlier about how important Scarpa was to the Mafia Commission case, to Rudy Giuliani's future. This was like the idea of Linda Vecchio, Mr. Organized Crime, who ran two units in the squads in the New York office, going down was like anathema to the Justice Department. So they did some extraordinary things during that OPR. Number one, Lynn took the Fifth Amendment. He refused to take a polygraph, which is the tried and true test. Everybody in the Bureau, they say, put them on the box when there's any question about when you're vetting a confidential informant, when you're vetting somebody to go undercover, right? When you're, checking whether or not there's another Robert Hansen in the midst, right? You put them on the box. Lynn DeVecchio refuses to take a polygraph, and then the Justice Department does the unheard of, John. They grant him immunity. What?
Perfect.
You're trying to get to the bottom of this investigation, and you give the guy immunity? So ultimately, Linda Vecchio walked And they ended the OPR in August of 96. And Lynn always says he was cleared. He wasn't cleared. The Justice Department simply concluded that they could not prosecute him. Why? Because they'd been granted immunity. And they didn't have enough evidence based on the immunity to prosecute. Now let's go back and look at Scarpa Jr., what's going on. He's passing this information that it warns of this bomb in the plane. Yusuf asked for a mistrial on the very day after the most damning evidence, Murad's confession, goes in. And now the FBI begins, they put like hundreds of agents out on Long Island the next day. For a plane crash? Never. Situation room meeting for a plane crash? Never. But again, they realize that this is probably a terrorist attack. So the first thing that starts to happen is the Navy dredges up that wreckage and they begin to paste together the plane. If you go to peterlance.com and you go a little bit down to the right, I brought it up pretty much to the top of the right-hand column, you'll see the pictures of the plane that as it was reconstructed. And as they start bringing it up and they have a sniffer at the dock, they have a little gas spectrum chromatograph that is, after they power clean the seaweed off the wreckage, they pick up, they trace elements of these explosives, RDX, PETN, and nitroglycerin. Did you hear me earlier when I talked about Yusuf's wet test in the Philippines? What was the bomb? It was a diluted nitroglycerin, calcium nitrate, right? What did Yusuf tell Scarpa in one of his memos that he could use as an explosive on a bomb device for a plane? RDX. Two of the three explosives found in the wreckage of TWA-800 were linked, at least verbally and physically, to Ramzi Yusuf. Now, here's what's going on. During the summer, there's a press conference every day. James Kaus from the ADIX in the New York office became famous over this case. He's presiding over it. And sometime in July, or late July, he says, because he's beginning to start to embrace the bomb theory, and he basically says, if we get another confirmation in the FBI lab on this initial, the results of this gas spectrum chromatograph at here on the dock, this becomes a crime scene. It's going to be sabotage, a bomb. He basically says that at a news conference, or words to that effect. And Don Van Atta Jr., one of the great reporters for the New York Times, begins preparing a story in August that, in fact, they're just about to confirm these findings. Now, on or about August 22nd, James Kallstrom is summoned to a meeting in Washington. And according to what I was able to uncover, at that meeting is Louis Free, the director, and Jamie Gorelick, a deputy attorney general, who later, if you remember, went on to become one of the 9/11 commissioners. Whatever is discussed at that meeting causes James Kallstrom to rush back to New York, and he finds out that Van Atta is going to go with a page one New York Times story the next day. Yes, evidence of explosives found on plane, evidence of a bomb, okay? And he tries to kill the story with Van Atta. Then he tries to call the Times editorial staff to kill it. No, they don't kill it. So the story is published the next day. Evidence of bomb on plane, okay? Now, Kallstrom, for whatever reason, suddenly goes into a kind of a different kind of mode, and he asks his people, is there any way we can explain the presence of high explosives on this plane absent a bomb? Basically, words to that effect. A memo is sent out to find out where the plane has been. And in September, they come up with this theory that on its face seems ridiculous. The theory is that on June 10th, 1996, 5 weeks before the fatal flight, the plane, the 747-100, that was TWA-800, which has an N number of 9317119, okay, that's the tail number, is on the C concourse at Lambert International Airport, the TWA's home port in St. Louis, at the end of this concourse, and that a police officer named Herman Burnett, a canine officer, conducts a bomb-sniffing dog qualification test on the plane while it's empty, awaiting, to be stocked and ready for its next flight. And that's what he would do in the regular course of business. He'd get on a flight. He didn't regularly record the N numbers. And he would get on and he would place essentially bait, explosive elements in containers, by the way, not like out. Like, he wouldn't just pour explosives onto the floor and have the dog find it. He would have these closed containers and put them in a zigzag pattern, let the dog go, see if he could find them, then record the results, okay? So the FBI basically puts out the theory that Herman Burnett did the test on the 10th, and he somehow spilled some of these explosives, and that's the explanation for the high explosives. And everybody went along. Don Van Atta, the New York Times, everybody knuckled under and embraced that theory. No.
But why, Peter? Why do they embrace it? I got two questions for you.
Mysteries that I can't answer. But let me tell you, who do you think the first reporter to ever talk to Herman Burnett was?
You.
Yeah. Right. So when I was doing the story, I fly to St. Louis one day. He's still working. He's just about to retire. I told him that I'd like to meet him at the Admiral's Club. He showed up with a dog, not the same dog, whose name was Carlo at the time. Wonderful man. And I looked at him and I said, "Mr. Burnett, you have grandchildren, children?" Yeah. I said, "They're going to go to their graves thinking that you screwed up." And he gave me kind of a glare and he said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Listen, in virtually every telling of this story before Congress, as the story got bigger and bigger, the FBI almost got to the point of like where you were like pouring the explosives and grinding it in with your feet on the plane. And they're painting you as the goat here, man. They're painting you as the screw up, okay? They're blaming this explosive thing on you. Now tell me the truth." And I gave him a copy of 1,000 Years for Revenge. I said, "You don't have to call me. I want you to read that book or read the timeline in the middle and call me if you believe in that I'm looking for the truth here." He said, "All right, that's fair enough." He calls me a couple of weeks later. He said, "What do you want to know?" I asked him about it. He said, "I told the FBI I did the test on a different plane. There were two 747s that day at the end of the C concourse. N17119 that the later became TWA-800, it departed at 12:35 p.m. A nearly identical plane, N number 9317116, was at gate 52, right, across the way. That's the plane I did the thing on." And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "Because everybody agrees, I agree, that I got off the plane at noon. As I got off the plane, the flight crew was beginning to come on, and TWA had a policy back then that the crew would have to arrive about 90 minutes prior to departure. So now I'm starting to see flight attendants, crew, come on, they're starting to stock the plane for the flight. The flight that became TWA 800, the fatal flight, that plane, that aircraft, departed 35 minutes after noon. 35 minutes later, it was fully catered, fully crewed. Impossible that he had done the test on that flight. Physically impossible, John. And he gave me the TWA date assignment for that day, which I published in my book Cover Up, and I've just reproduced at peterlance.com on my TWA 800 page. And although it's a little small and hard to read, if you get anybody can order Cover Up and get either the hard copy or get the Kindle edition of it go to peterlance.com and link to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you'll see, I sent you a copy tonight, you can just look at these documents, and it's like astonishing. So now, in talking to me, I have shattered the FBI's only explanation for the presence of high explosives on the flight. So now, while I'm writing my book, I call the great James Kallstrom, the edict of the New York office, who acquiesced and about a year later in 1997 and rolled over to the theory of the NTSB that there was an electrical short that caused an explosion in the gas fumes in the tank that exploded the plane. The mechanical theory, okay? The non-sabotage theory, which is right. Still the official theory. So I call Kallstrom, I'm interviewing him. When I told him what I had heard about Burnett, there's like a pause. I mean, like, I think the guy almost fell off his chair down in Delaware where I did he was by phone. And so then he said, but he recovered very quickly. And he said, "Well, Peter, even arguendo that might be the case, hypothesizing that you might be right, our chief metallurgist, William Tobin, found no indicia of bomb damage on the plane." In other words, he looked at the plane and he could see nothing to indicate a bomb was used. And that ultimately, he agreed with the NTSB theory, and I ended up agreeing, okay? So I get a hold of William Tobin, who had been retired at that point, but he was still in private practice. And I said, "Mr. Tobin, when you did your model to decide what was indicia of bomb damage on TWA-800, which of the two prior bombings on 747, Boeing 747, there were two bombings prior to TWA-800 crash, which of the two did you include both of those two bombings?" And he goes, "What do you mean two?" And I said, "Well, Pan Am 103 at Lockerbie, Scotland, where there's almost a liter or half a liter of Semtex checked for explosive that was planted in the luggage, and that on its own in a Toshiba boombox blew up the plane on its own, detonated in the cargo bay, bringing the plane down over Lockerbie." And he goes, "Yeah, and what's the other one?" And I said, "What's the other one? The other one was Ramzi Youssef's wet test in Manila. of the Philippine Airlines Flight 434. And he goes, I can't remember that. And I said, what? Yeah, I said, I can't remember. I said, well, wait a minute. You can't remember. Okay, let me ask you something. Did you have an office in New York that summer? You came up from Virginia? Yeah. Did they put you at 26 Federal Plaza? Yeah. Did you have an office on which side of the building, the Hudson River, the west side or the east side? Well, I think I was overlooking by the Brooklyn Bridge. Okay. Did you look down on Foley Square right in front of you, and did you see a courthouse across the street? Yeah. Did you see a bunch of microwave trucks all summer long covering a big trial? Yeah. That was the Bojinka trial, Mr. Tobin. And at the Bojinka trial, the feds that summer rolled out the whole story of the Philippine Airlines Flight 434. It was in evidence. How could you have not included that? And how can you not remember that? And this is the way I'm talking to this guy on the phone. I guess he'd probably never been spoken to by a reporter in his life, and certainly not the way I was talking to him. But I was being aggressive because I was in semi-shocked myself that the man who James Kallstrom vouched for as the one who was really the definitive, it was his call, as to whether or not there was bomb damage, and he couldn't remember whether he'd used the Ramzi Youssef's precursor as like a model, and he
Peter, this is extraordinary. This is extraordinary. I'm wondering, is it this sort of a lack of information? Is it this sort of thing that makes some of these operations, I mean, up to and including drone operations, so clumsy with so much collateral damage? It's almost like the big beast of a security service sort of goes, oh, there it is over there. So they launch something big enough at the problem to make sure and neutralize it, irrespective of how much other stuff it's neutralizing at the same time. I mean, why are these operations, you must have wondered, why are these operations sometimes so clumsy?
Well, one of the things that I found, and this is now, I've done four books, thousands of pages of book, pages in books, and literally now probably 100,000 pages of documents that I've read in 12 years of being on this story, John. The astonishing amount of screw-ups by the best and the brightest. We're talking about the two Bin Laden offices of origin, the New York office of the FBI and the Southern District. And we're not talking about the Keokuk, Iowa office, the resident, the RA. We're not talking about Durango, Colorado. We're talking about the best of the best, and how many times they screwed up over the years, and especially with the massive amounts of money that was thrown at them. But I need to bring this home one last time to bring it back to the mob story, to deal with the devil and Scarpa Jr., okay? The question that begs to be answered, which is impossible and can only be answered by Jamie Gorelick, Louis Free, or James Kallstrom, is what was said in that meeting in Washington. What caused James Kallstrom, who to that point was, for all accounts, open to both, all theories at that point in August, up until then. He really was. He was saying it publicly. I'm open to the missile theory. I'm open to the bomb theory. We want to get to the truth. That's the way Kallstrom was behaving in front of the press. Suddenly, he's like squashing the bomb theory, trying to kill stories in the New York Times. They come up with this fakakta, is that, the Yiddish word? I think I can use that on the radio. Theory about the bomb-sniffing dog, which was clearly, patently false, okay? And anybody that had done any investigation beyond the FBI could have found that, as I did. And so what was the motive? And the motive, I believe, is this. If Scarpa Jr. was made credible on what he was saying about Ramzi Youssef in that sting of 11 months, he would have been later credible at his trial in 1998, where his main defense was, I was acting at the advice and consent of the FBI under my father's orders. That was his principal defense. And if that defense had held, and if Scarpa Jr.'s credibility had held based on this intelligence from Ramzi Youssef, those 75 cases would have unraveled. So in my opinion, this is my studied opinion, the Justice Department made an ends justifies the means decision. In the summer, in August of 1996, they decided that letting 75 mob guys out of jail would be much more damaging than giving credence to Ramzi Youssef. They knew they were going to convict Ramzi Youssef at trial. They knew, they believed essentially that this al-Qaeda threat to New York had diminished, was basically over. And so they said, you know what, if we give credence to Scarpa Jr., we're screwed. So you know what they did? They actually branded these dozens and dozens of FBI 302s, which documented this intelligence initiative over 11 months, the sting of Ramzi Youssef by Scarpa. They called it a hoax and a scam.
Well, let's stop right there, man. That's beautiful. A hoax and a scam. We'll be right back with our final segment with Peter Lance in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're coming up on our final segment with Peter Lance tonight, and it's amazing the amount of information that he has spoken tonight. It's one of those things that you have to sit back and let it all soak in, and then the dots appear, and then you're able to connect them. Happy Independence Weekend to everybody. Thanks very much for being with us tonight on the program. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Peter Lance, this used to happen all the time in class, but bring me around to an understanding here. Why, one more time, why would the cases fall apart?
If you have, if you're the government and you're prosecuting criminals, and in fact, what you're doing is suborning, using your own intelligence and the resources of the government to help other criminals kill some of the people that you're prosecuting, right? Some of the Colombo War defendants were the targets of Gregory Scarpa.
So this would come out in court.
Right, to be able, like Vicarina particularly, had a right to assert that he was part of a conspiracy, that they wanted Scarpa to take over the family. So he instigated the war. They aided and abetted him by giving him intelligence. And Vicarina had the right to know that. So if Vicarina, whose trial happened, and never knew, his lawyer, Gus Newman, never knew, then he would have grounds for a mistrial, I mean, a new trial, et cetera, an appeal. Now, let's just get back to the hoax and the scam thing. And I'm remiss if I don't point out, I have to say this because I have this remarkable young woman named Sherry Roberts who's been helping me learn about social network and everything. She created a Facebook page for me. If you go to peterlance.com and scroll down and go to the page, and I'd appreciate it because that really helps. You know, from a multitude of tongues comes the truth, and tweeting and tagging really is a good thing, okay? But now let me get back to the story. What happened was the following. They, in order for the feds to discredit Scarpa Jr. after they've had 11 months of these FBI 302 memos documenting his intelligence, they have to discredit it. So they come up with this theory that it's a hoax and a scam. Who is the main principal enunciator of this theory? Patrick Fitzgerald. Patrick Fitzgerald was the former head of, he wore two hats. He was the co-head of organized crime and terrorism in the Southern District. So he straddled both of these issues. And Patrick Fitzgerald had visited with Scarpa Jr. and his lawyer in jail. One of the people with him was Dietrich Snell, who was the guy that ended up taking my testimony in the 9/11 commission hearings and burying it. You know, Dietrich Snell was one of the guys from the Philippines that got the information from the Philippines. He's now prosecuting Ramzi Youssef and the Bojinka. I mean, you talk about a very limited universe of people here, okay? And
yes.
Patrick Fitzgerald issues a sworn affirmation years later that was under seal for years, and I published it at the end of Triple Cross. And in that affirmation, Patrick Fitzgerald said that initially we believed that the Scarpa materials, which is what they're called, the treasure trove of intel from Youssef, was genuine. But we later came to understand, and he says in the late summer of 96, it's right around the time of this meeting in Washington, right? We began to realize that it was a hoax and a scam, a fabrication created by Youssef and Scarpa Jr. Now, ask yourself, why would Greg Scarpa, who had a 10th grade, how could he, with a 10th grade education, do these bomb formulas and schematics? Impossible. Why would Ramzi Youssef have a hoax? Because in some of those 302s, Scarpa is putting him into murders and additional crimes. Why would Youssef, who's representing himself, do that? There's no motive. Now, if you go to peterlance.com during the break, and I love the web, you know, I love the internet, because I added on my website, while the commercials were going, right below in the right-hand column, a Playboy magazine piece that I did in 2009 called The Chilling Effect, okay? And that story not only documents the authenticity of the Scarpa materials, but it tells the story of how Patrick Fitzgerald, understand who he was. He was the man who was appointed special prosecutor in the Valerie Plame investigation, Valerie Plame. He was appointed the U.S. attorney in Chicago. He's the guy that prosecuted Blagojevich, one of probably the most fearsome and powerful U.S. attorney in the Justice Department for many years. And starting in the fall of 2007, for 20 months, he began a campaign to kill my book, Triple Cross, that book. He sent 32 pages of threat letters to HarperCollins threatening to sue for libel. Little single-spaced letters that he must have written on weekends, because, I mean, if he was doing his job as U.S. attorney, I don't know how he found the time. And he didn't lay a glove on me. He brought up one mistake, misdating I had on one article on MSNBC that I cited in my book, and I had like 1,400 endnotes. It was meticulously researched, Triple Cross, you know, 600 pages. And he didn't lay a glove on me, but he put HarperCollins and me through the ringer for 20 months. We had to revet the whole book out of a multitude of caution, considering who it was from. In one of his letters, he actually faxed it, said Office of U.S. Attorney Chicago, hence the term chilling effect, right, to intimidate us. And this is the guy who put away, the only person he jailed in the entire Valerie Plame investigation was Judy Miller of the New York Times, who went away for 85 days, okay? Even when when Fitzgerald knew that the leaker of Plame's a non-official cover was Richard Armitage, he knew it, he still put this woman in jail. So he's gunning for me. Now ask yourself, ask your listeners, why would if Peter Lance was a nutcase, if Peter Lance was some guy with tin foil on his head who believed in, you know, that Martians were running the whole show, why would Patrick Fitzgerald, the most formidable U.S. attorney, spend this amount of time trying to kill my book? Okay? And to the credit of Michael Morrison, chairman of HarperCollins, and Jane Friedman, who preceded them, and my editor, Cal Morgan, and Beth Sylvan, the great general counsel there, we put that book out in trade paperback. We actually added 26 pages in 2009, which included the entire Fitzgerald, the story of what Fitzgerald tried to do. As recently as June, 2 weeks before publication, John, he said, if this book is published and it libels me or holds me in a false light, I will sue HarperCollins. Guess what? Didn't lay a glove on us. Scuttled into the dark. Fitzgerald never did anything. It was all an exercise in intimidation, because he never had a case in the first place. He's a public figure, and for him to have sustained a libel case against me, he would have had to prove reckless disregard for the truth or malice. Impossible. But that's what I'm talking about in terms of the stakes. So when Scarpa Jr. comes up for trial, the judge, Rena Raji, former U.S. attorney in the Eastern District, right? She says, oh, no, I believe it's a hoax and a scam. She buys the theory, and she sentences Greg, who is not convicted of a single murder, Junior, sentences him to 40 years in the Supermax prison in Colorado. And that's where he was for X amount of years until he got transferred out this summer. He's in front of Judge Corman, that one of the good judges I told you about that gave those 14 guys another shot. And Judge Corman now is hearing a 2255 hearing, and I sent him a whole package on Greg, asking the judge to consider Greg like essentially a sentence reduction and let him out, because not only did he sting Ramzi Youssef, but really quickly in 2005, he actually found out from Terry Nichols, who was in an adjoining cell in the Supermax, and they communicated through a sink, adjoining sinks between them, and he actually found out that Terry Nichols, there was an undiscovered cache of explosives in Terry Nichols' home in Harrington, Kansas, that the feds had never found when they searched the home of the Oklahoma City bomber in 1995, and that Nichols was afraid that others unknown on the 10th anniversary were going to use it. So Angela Clemente, once again, through her partner, the late Dr. Stephen Dresch, contacted me. She tried to get a couple of congressmen to do something, Bill Delahunt, Dana Rohrabacher. They weren't able to do anything. I contacted John Solomon, who was then the bureau chief for the AP in Washington, a fantastic reporter. He's now editor of the Washington Times. John Solomon put some pressure on the bureau. They went out and guess what, John? They found the explosives, kind sticks, exactly where Greg Jr. told them they would be. So this guy, Scarpa Jr., the son of the killing machine, the Mad Hatter, the Grim Reaper, stung two of the greatest terrorists ever to inflict damage on America, Ramzi Youssef and Terry Nichols. And he's buried in a federal jail cell. And I think he should be given clemency. If Sammy the Bull Gravano killed 19 people and got 5 years, Greg Jr. deserves to see the light of day, and so does Vicarina.
Because Greg never killed anybody, I take it, or at least he wasn't accused
Greg
of it.
No, he did kill people. Now, let me back up. And no, nothing can take, nothing, you know, nothing can justify those murders that he committed. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like Henry, I'm not Norman Mailer who's soft peddling Jack Henry Abbott and trying to get him out of jail. Remember that incident? I'm not a mob lover and I'm not a mob buff, but I'm a justice person and I'm a truth seeker, okay? And if Scarpa Jr. performed for the government, and that notion of that 11-month Youssef sting was a hoax is absolute hogwash. And go to, again, peterlance.com, go down to the right-hand column, The Chilling Effect, just read it, click on it. Read my story for Playboy. It was on playboy.com, so it went off eventually, and I made a PDF of it, but that's the exact story as it appeared. It's got the schematics, everything I talked about earlier. You can see how authentic that was. And the Terry Nichols thing was authenticated by an AP national story after the fact. It mentioned Greg, Dr. Dresch, me, you know, the Nichols, the whole thing. So he deserves downward release time. There's a federal rule, 5K1.1, that says if you provide substantial assistance to the government, you shall have downward release. And I think if anybody qualifies, it's Scarpa Jr.
This is absolutely unbelievable to me. So let's you know, you're an investigative reporter. You're not a philosopher.
I was a philosophy major, though, John.
Well, that'll work then. Good. Well, then you just opened the door very wide. What is? I don't understand this. This sounds to me like it's all political. It's all.
You know what it is? As Rory O'Connor, this great documentary filmmaker and columnist, said about when he reviewed Triple Cross, he said it's a conspiracy to cover up incompetence. Okay, when the first. Look, go read the timeline, peterlance.com, scroll down, you'll see the timeline below The Chilling Effect, the picture of Ali Muhammad. It goes back to that Calvert and surveillance in 1989, right? And they were onto these guys, and they screwed up. They kept screwing up and screwing up. Then the Trade Center, then Rabbi Kahane's murder, they screw up again. The Trade Center bomb goes off. And by the way, the Day of Terror case was absolutely what I call the makeup case for failing to stop the Trade Center bombing. And another important link on my site has to do with Ahmed Salem. And I was on with George with Ahmed. Ahmed was the Egyptian undercover operative that went in and infiltrated the blind sheikh. And he was incredibly invaluable. And what happened? The bureau, a new guy, head of terrorism, came in, Carson Dunbar, didn't like him, didn't like Nancy Floyd, his tough control agent. So he changed the rules, said, you got to wear a wire. He withdrew. Guess what? The Trade Center bombs go off. And John Anticev, that agent I told you about earlier, admitted to Ahmed on tape, we could have stopped the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 if we just listened to you. So right after the bombing, Ahmed feels guilt-ridden, even though he shouldn't have, and he goes undercover and he rounds up the blind sheikh and 11 others in this Day of Terror plot over X number of months. They set up a sting operation. He goes into witness protection for 14 years after convicting the blind sheikh in the Day of Terror case, prosecuted properly by Patrick Fitzgerald and Andy McCarthy, and he contacts me in 2009. I'm speaking at NYU, and he gets out of witness protection, and I get together with him in New York. We're incredibly close friends now, and he just gave me chapter and verse on how these guys screwed up repeatedly. So they're embarrassed, John. They don't want to admit they're false. They didn't want to connect the dots on the original bombing in 9/11, which is why for years they denied it. Patrick Fitzgerald denied it in an interview in 2005. The 9/11 Commission for Dietrich Snell, Staff Statement 15, denied it. And I was vindicated in April of 2010. And if you go to buy Deal with the Devil, and I ask everybody within the sound of your voice, get Deal with the Devil. You will not be disappointed. It's an absolute page-turner. It reads like a novel, but it's totally true. Buy the latest book first, and if you find my work valuable, then go back and read the others. But in the afterword to this book, I show there are two now indictments of Ramzi Youssef, the original Trade Center bombing indictment, right, 1993, and what do they do? And quietly, in 2010, April, the Southern District updated the superseding indictment to include Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and all of the victims of 9/11. I was vindicated. What I said in 2003, and George Noori had me on the show back then, had some faith in me, and took a chance, and I put that theory out there, and nobody believed me for years, and I was vindicated by the Southern District. So what I'm with the bottom line, philosophically speaking, is if you never give up, if you keep kicking over rocks, if you keep pressing for the truth will come. As Justice Leonard Hand once said, it comes from a multitude of tongues. And Louis Brandeis said, another great judge, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And this whole thing where they're trying to prosecute Snowden, where they're trying to prosecute Julian Assange, 95% of the material that I've uncovered over the years when I've encountered these, oh, it's national security, you can't know, you don't want to tell you, it's because they're trying to cover up their own incompetence, okay? Right? It's not, now look, there are serious lapses from time to time, John, and nobody wants a covers of identity given away. And I'm not trying to throw the baby out with the bathwater because I haven't looked at everything in the Snowden dump and I haven't looked at everything in the Assange WikiLeaks dump. But most of the time, the government wants to prosecute these people who give this information out because they don't want the public to know the truth.
Because it's a career ender for a lot of them. If they do know the truth, that they're over with.
Absolutely. And I can do this in 3 minutes. Is that in my book and on my website, Google, or you can Google this. There's I have an article on Huffington Post. It's called Al-Qaeda and the Mob, How the FBI Blew It on 9/11. It's on, you can just Google it, Al-Qaeda and the Mob. And in that, I'm going to do this in three dots. In 1991, the feds, the New York Office of the Bureau, knew that El Sayed Nasser, the killer of Kahani, had a mailbox at Sphinx Trading, a little check cashing store in Jersey City, Kennedy Boulevard, located beneath the Blind Sheikh's Al Salam Mosque, okay, the mosque of the Prince of Jihad, the Blind Sheikh Rahman. 1994, Patrick Fitzgerald and Andy McCarthy have a list of 172 unindicted co-conspirators in the Day of Terror case. Who's on it? Bin Laden, Ali Mohammed, all the major players. Another guy that's on it is Waleed al-Noor, the co-incorporator of Sphinx. Obviously, Fitzgerald and McCarthy thought he was a powerful enough player to put him on the list. John, where do you think two of the 9/11 hijackers got their fake IDs in July of 2001, before the attacks?
I give up.
Sphinx Trading. From Mohammed Al-Atras, the partner of Waleed al-Noor. And here's the point I make in that article. If the feds had devoted 5% of the energy that they spent forever bothering Italians, where they were obsessed with getting John Gotti, the number one priority, the New York office of the FBI, for years was getting Gotti. If they had a surveillance 24 hours a day around the clock of the Ravenite Social Club year after year after year, if they had devoted 5% of the resources that they put on to break the mafia enemy, and they'd put a perch or a plant across the street from Sphinx Trading, they would have been in the middle of the 9/11 plot in July. With all the chatter that was going on that summer, with the Phoenix memo and July 10th, they would have been in the middle of the plot. Al-Madar and Al-Hazmi, who flew AA-77 into the Pentagon, got their fake IDs at a check-cashing store that the FBI knew about in 1991. And Patrick Fitzgerald and Andy McCarthy, two of the senior feds in the Southern District, thought important enough to have the co-incorporator on a list with Bin Laden in 1994. I rest my case.
You know, man, this is absolutely unbelievable because, I mean, the holographic planes flying into the buildings, the George W. Bush and Cheney, Dick Cheney, orchestrated the entire thing. No planes hit the buildings. Missiles hitting TWA 800 and all of this. And when you lay this all out, and I mean, it sounds like it's all been substantiated. In the end, it's just plain human stupidity and selfishness. It's beyond any damn thing that I've ever even thought of. You think it's going to be some really super sophisticated, well planned out, everything is orchestrated by the wizard who's behind the curtain, and it's just like, no. It's just a coincidence of bad moves and bad decisions. That's it.
The cover-up of the embarrassment of the bad moves. And that, there was no stovepiping within the FBI. It was the FBI. They knew what they were doing, you know? And this is the saddest part of this. And here's the final bottom line. If you read Deal with the Devil, guess how many Arab-speaking, Farsi and Urdu-speaking agents they have 12 years on after 9/11. Guess how many in the Bureau out of 5,000 working counterterrorism?
Okay, I'm going to say 150.
Yeah, exactly. Plus 350 support personnel, which is less than 2%. So no wonder they don't get a Tamerlan Chermayev, even though the Russians are screaming at him. No wonder they miss a Faisal Shahzad, who, again, by the grace of God, that bomb in Times Square didn't go off that Saturday night, even though they were on to him in 2006. the Joint Terrorism Task Force interviewed the guy he sold a condo to, Faisal Shahzadi, goes to Waziristan, learns how to build a weapon of mass destruction, parks in Times Square on a Saturday night, and the FBI doesn't know?
You know what? I got a feeling that frequent trips to your website, peterlance.com, would be a really good idea for everybody. Peter, thanks for being on the program. It was a real eye-opener, I'll tell you.
Great to meet you, John.
Thanks for the time. Well, so there it is, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, children being those who have not lost their sense of wonder. It's a conspiracy, all right. It's maybe just not the conspiracy that we thought it was, or have been led to believe, that is. All righty then. Have a pleasant rest of the Independence weekend. Remember why we observe Independence Day. And I'll talk to you next Saturday night. Until then and beyond, good night and be well.